at Revolution Radio.
The journey begins to fun, health, and freedom.
Syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, yeah, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome to Conversations with Eagle Flower, this ninth day of November in 2022. As always, my affirmation welcomes the listeners of Revolution Radio who come from far and wide, from many cultures, creeds, and nationalities around this world. And we all come to this table of life to learn from and with each other in the best possible way. We acknowledge that no race and no person is better than another. We all experience this gift of life from our mutual Creator. Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio and supporting us here, as we are a listener-supported station. And also, thank you for supporting us just by listening to our presentations. We do have the nav bar on the front page, which includes our schedules for Studios A and B, the archives. Of course, that good old donation tab. And the contact tab, if you would like to contact management for any reason. As always, I like to give a special shout out to all of the chatters at Revolution Radio, whether you're listening now or later. And, of course, to our furry and feathered friends. My Eagle Flower saying is, let's learn together and build our best future. Well, how is everyone doing out there today? I am certainly getting the impression that there's a lot of uneasiness, shall I say. And I hope that everyone really can settle down a little bit and get a little bit quieted, because I think more than ever from here on out, it's very, very important that we find our calmness and use it to our advantage. Because we are so close to the 11th of November today, I'm going to be doing Remembering Our Military Veterans. And believe me, I understand the pros and the cons of military. I am not naive. I am a military veteran. I saw right away the, shall I say, dichotomy of being in the military and what it really means. So I do not speak from naivety on this. There are 2 days in this country specifically for honoring military veterans and soldiers. They are Memorial Day and Veterans Day, which is upcoming November the 11th. And these are difficult days for some families and for many military, especially in these times. There are no easy answers when questioning the purpose of wars, of provoking others into wars, and of ongoing division across this world. Many of us clearly see the patterns of centuries and millennia in this conquest for control. If anything, it should clearly bring home to us that in most cases, warring is futile. War never brings peace. If you know of a military veteran, do not greet this former soldier or veteran with Happy Veterans Day. Instead, extend your hand and thank him or her for the service that they did. There is nothing to be happy about, as far as I'm concerned, on Veterans Day. Today, I will present a variety of articles and stories that are worth hearing. In this first story that I'm going to read, I don't know its veracity, but it is hilarious. And it's called A Funny Transcript of an Actual Military Conversation. And this is how it starts. This is the transcript of an actual radio conversation of a U.S. naval ship with Canadian authorities off the coast of Newfoundland in October 1995. Radio conversation released by the Chief of Naval Operations on November 10th, 1995. From the American ship, please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. The Canadians reply, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. American reply, this is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. Canadians, no. I say again, you divert your course. American reply, and this is all in bold letters. This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. That's 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of this ship. The Canadian's response is, this is a lighthouse. Your call. Like I say, I don't know its veracity, but for it to have happened in 1995, I think it's funny. Next, I will read an extended article. Actually, it's a 2-part article on the famous Bonus March of 1932. At one time or another, we may have heard tidbits of this story, but I had never heard the whole story until finding it several days ago. The details of this story are both exhilarating as well as horrendous, taking their turns. Younger people today question if our military would ever turn on its own. listen well today on how government and the military plays its games. And as I turn over to it, this what I found in its the website is called Veterans Breakfast Club. When veterans stormed the Capitol, the March of the Bonus Army of 1932. This was written by Todd De Pastino. The March of the Bonus Army in 1932 pitted 45,000 World War I veterans and their families against the United States government during the depths of the Great Depression. The veterans had marched on Washington to demand early payment of a bonus due to them in 1945 for their service in the Great War. The White House and the Army saw the marchers as a threat and schemed to drive them from the nation's capital. The story features some already famous people like President Herbert Hoover and Chief of Staff of the United States Army, Douglas MacArthur. It also previews some soon-to-be celebrities such as Majors Dwight D. Eisenhower and George S. Patton. The drama played out months before one of the most important elections in American history. It's not too much of an exaggeration to claim that the Bonus March sealed the fate of Herbert Hoover and paved the way for Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. To understand the Bonus March, you need to go back to 1917, when the U.S. declared war on Germany on April 6th of that year. The U.S. Army counted fewer than 200,000 soldiers. It would soon balloon to over 4 million due to something called the Selective Service, the first modern draft. The idea was to have all Americans serve the war effort one way or another. Some would be selected to fight in army, others would be selected to work in munitions plants. 2 million of those selected for military service crowded onto giant troop ships and headed overseas to France. Over the next year or so of combat, 112,000 of those U.S. service members would die, half from the Spanish flu. But American power had tipped the scales, broken the trench war stalemate, and forced Germany's capitulation on November 11, 1918. The doughboys, as they were called, came back to parades and victory celebrations. But just as disillusionment over the war emerged in 1919 with the Versailles Treaty and the peace, he's got quoted here, peace to end all peace, and I'm not sure that that's correct. I've always heard of it as being peace to end all wars, so I'm not sure if that's a typo. So did awareness dawn that those who had been selected to work in industry earned 10 times the amount of money. I'll repeat that. Those who had been selected to work in industry or private industry earned 10 times the amount of money or more than those who had shipped overseas. In 1924, Congress sought to repair this imbalance by passing the World War Service Adjusted Compensation Act, which awarded veterans $1 a day for every day spent in uniform in the U.S. and $1.25 for each day overseas. By compounding interest over time, the Act promised to deliver a one-time payment of between $500 to $1,000 to every former doughboy. There was one catch. The money wouldn't be paid immediately. The veterans had to wait until 1945 to receive the check. Now, we're talking that's 20 years later, okay? Meanwhile, they're in the Depression at this point. Going back to the article. This was, as you can imagine, an expensive proposition. Detractors didn't call it a just in compensation. They called it a bonus. The nickname stuck. Soon everyone in America was aware of the World War I bonus payment coming due in 21 years. In 1924, few groused about having to wait so long for payment. It was the Roaring Twenties and the economy was booming. Herbert Hoover won the White House in 1928 with a campaign slogan, "A chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage." "We in America," President Hoover is quoted as saying, "are nearer to the financial triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of our land." A year later, as we all know, the stock market collapsed and Hoover was proven tragically wrong. Every week, month, year seemed to deepen the economic morass. By 1932, the unemployment rate scudded to 25%. The nation was in crisis. Hoover's response, in retrospect, was too little, too late. But to be fair, there was no template for the kind of executive action needed, because there had never been an economic collapse so severe. The old assumptions and outdated dogmas of the past, to paraphrase Lincoln, were inadequate for the stormy present. Hoover's Reconstruction Finance Corporation was nowhere near big enough or generous enough to make any difference in his December 2, 1930 message to Congress. And in it, he declared, quote, "Economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive pronouncement," end quote. In other words, there was nothing to be done. The invisible hand of the market would have to work out the cure on its own timetable, and government could do nothing. When government fails to respond to crisis, people search elsewhere for answers. And this was especially true during the Great Depression, when mainstream state solutions didn't scale to the problem. When the political center collapses, the fringes come to life. Radical elements on the left and the right gain in prestige and popularity. What once seemed crackpot no longer appears so crazy. In the 1930s, the Communist Party rose to unprecedented prominence right here in the land of liberty. Most American cities had Communist Party halls. There you could go, get a cup of coffee and a sandwich, and maybe listen to a lecture about the failure of capitalism and the need for a new system. The Communist Party of America sponsored hunger marches, unemployment demonstrations that drew hundreds of thousands of people. Similar movements rocked Europe and even Japan. Opposing communists everywhere were the fascists, who occupied the other end of the political spectrum. In Italy, they were called the Black Shirts and led by Benito Mussolini. In Britain, Oswald Mosley led his own Black Shirt Legion, while in Germany, the preferred shirt color was brown, and the leader was Adolf Hitler. Unemployed Americans rallied in blue shirts and found a leader in a Pittsburgh priest named Father James Cox. In January 1932, Father Cox, who was no fascist in terms of ideology, nonetheless borrowed from the right-wing movement stylings in a march of 25,000 on Washington to demand a public works program and 70% inheritance tax. Colored shirts and extended right-arm salutes lent a militaristic air to Cox's army. There was an ominous feeling in the air. The country seemed on the edge of something seismic. If you were to ask Americans in 1932 where the nation would be in 5 years, most would answer, revolution. Some in Congress were aware of the need to do something big. In early 1932, Texas Congressman Wright Patman, a populist Democrat, introduced a bill calling for the federal government to pay out that World War I adjusted compensation bonus immediately instead of waiting until 1945. It wasn't a bad idea. Poor families of veterans would receive a much-needed infusion of cash, but the bill was also good on a macro level. The Depression was a deflationary crisis. Prices fell because demand was low. What was needed was stimulus, and the bonus would have provided a $2.4 billion boost to spending. President Hoover vowed to veto it on account of the enormous expense. And Hoover wasn't alone in opposition to the bill. Republicans and many of Patman's fellow Democrats also disapproved of the scheme and the deficit spending it would require. So as with so many measures, the bill died in committee. Across the country in Portland, Oregon, a World War I veteran named Walter W. Waters heard about the so-called bonus bill and grew interested in it. That interest swelled into an obsession. For someone who triggered a history-making event, Walter Waters remains surprisingly mysterious. We know he was from Portland, Oregon, and was an infantry sergeant who saw combat, including poison gas. We also know he came home a changed man and drifted from job to job. He seemed unable to settle down or keep a household. In 1925, he changed his name to Bill Kincaid, hoping, he said, to turn his luck. The Depression killed whatever promise of recovery he seemed to entertain. On March 15, 1932, when he attended a veterans meeting in Portland, Waters was just another down-and-out American, an unemployed cannery worker ready to turn full-time hobo. He stood up that evening and made a bold proposition to the glowering men. Every one of us, he declared, should hop a freight train and ride to Washington to demand in person the money due to us for our service overseas. It says everything about the dire state of the country that the men not only agreed with Waters, but pledged to join him on this trek. Over the next 2 months, Water recruited some 300 veterans to make the journey. On May 11th, the men boarded empty boxcars, still reeking of cow manure, and began their cross-country trip as the Bonus Expeditionary Force, later known as the BEF. They had, on average, 30 cents apiece. But they were helped all along the way, first by railroad employees, conductors, brakemen, and yardmen who facilitated their transit, then by the townspeople they met as they made their way east. By the time the Bonus Army reached Chicago, it had caught the nation's attention. Keep in mind, this is the day before computerization. Probably most people didn't even have telephones in those days. Going back to the article, the media loved everything about it. Here were 300 men standing for the 2 million other Americans who were on the road and dispossessed not only of their worldly goods, but of their faith in the American promise. Here were men on the move, heading to the seat of government, poor but determined, hungry but defiant. In short, Waters and the veterans were inspiring. And as they passed through the country's heartland, they took on other desperate recruits with nothing to lose. Commander Waters' ragtag army swelled, but maintained strict military discipline. Each man had a rank and a job. Such orderliness attracted supporters. People came out to give them food, clothing, blankets, donations, and job offers. Police ensured safe passage. They were full-blown, depression-born celebrities. Then something amazing happened. As the Portland BEF chugged across the country, other groups of veterans and their families packed up their belongings and started heading toward Washington. These copycats came from every corner of the country, New England and New Mexico, Pittsburgh and West Virginia, with huge numbers from Southern California. Veterans caught freights, piled into jalopies, and hitchhiked to the nation's capital. By the time Waters and the Portland BEF arrived on May 29th, there already were 10,000 bonus marchers in Washington. It was only the beginning. And now I'm going to click over to part two of this article. I don't know about you, but I find this fascinating. And a lot of this is, we can really almost put, I can't say like a blueprint, but we can superimpose so much of this stuff into what we've been seeing for the last recent years, can't we? The veterans first settled into a row of condemned buildings along Pennsylvania Avenue between the White House and the Capitol. But they soon ran out of space there as more men, women, and children arrived in Washington. The Bonus Army took over a section of shore along the Anacostia River from the Capitol. This floodplain, or mud flats, became the headquarters and main camp of the Bonus Army. At least 25,000 people pitched tents and built shacks. They laid out streets, put up fences, and began improving their homes. The Bonus encampment became a spectacle in itself. People came from all over the country, and the world came to see it. It was a sight that defied stereotypes of disorderly mobs or degenerate rabble. The camp was orderly and disciplined. Under Walter Waters' watchful eye, military protocol prevailed. Waters made sure every new arrival got registered and that only veterans and their families lived in the camp. There were mess halls and latrines, parade grounds and chapels. There were even schools for the children. In a depression-racked nation dotted with homeless camps, nicknamed Hoovervilles, in cutting reference to the president, the Bonus Army was a model community of the down and out. And I have to tell you that that's a little bit of an exaggeration, because they show several photos here of this camp, and believe me, it is very ragtag. That they could maintain order and discipline was fantastic. And they're also showing where they literally are in wallowing in mud. You can see water in the potholes. Going back to the article, law enforcement, of course, kept a watchful eye on the ragtag assemblage. Luckily for the Bonus Marchers, the chief of Washington, D.C. police was Pelham Glassford, a tall commanding man who had been a brigadier general in World War I. Glassford had tremendous sympathy for the protest and saw himself as an ally of the movement, even as he worked to protect the D.C. community against any of its pernicious effects. Glassford partnered with Waters to keep order. He helped to lay out camp in Anacostia and reached into his own pocket to supply the marchers with food, blankets, medicine, and building materials. He recruited wealthy Washingtonians to contribute to the Bonus Army's upkeep. One such supporter was socialite Evelyn Walsh McLean, who provided thousands of dollars worth of provisions for protesters. She donated 150-pound turtles to make soup, enough pork to make barbecue and for 1,500 vets and their families. She had thousands of cups of coffee delivered each day. She could afford it. She owned the Hope Diamond. Meanwhile, Chief Glassford arranged ongoing fundraisers for the marchers. There were boxing matches and sporting events, concerts, flag sitters, magic shows, and plays, all to raise money. The owner of a burlesque house staged a special strip show as a benefit. Most controversial thing about the Bonus Army was its racial politics. In a country where its military was strictly segregated, the Bonus Army and the camps were completely integrated. Roy Wilkins, who would later head the NAACP, was a young reporter for the Black Press. He visited the camp and wrote, quote, "There I found black toes and white toes sticking out side by side from a ramshackle town of pup tents, packing crates in tar paper shacks. Black men and white men, veterans of the segregated army that had fought in World War I, lined up equally," end quote. To Director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, to Army Chief of Staff, Douglas MacArthur, such racial integration was a sign that the Bonus Markers were subversives, probably communists. One of J. Edgar Hoover's agents reported, quote, "We observe Negroes and people with Jewish features among the marchers," end quote. Army intelligence and FBI agents issued frightening reports to the White House that the Bonus Army was the vanguard of a revolutionary group harboring plans to take over Washington and overthrow the nation's government. MacArthur ordered soldiers stationed at nearby Fort Myers to ready themselves to fight a civil insurrection. As MacArthur prepared for battle, the House of Representatives pulled the Wright-Patman bonus bill out of committee and put it up for a vote. On June 15th, the House passed the bill by a small margin, and the bonus marchers were jubilant. It seemed as though promised land was in sight. The adjusted compensation due to the veterans might be paid immediately instead of having to wait until 1945. The marchers held vigil outside the Senate for 2 days as that chamber debated the bill. At 9:30 p.m. on June 17th, a Senate aide passed news to Walter Waters. The Senate had voted to table the bill by an overwhelming majority. It would not be taken up again until 1933. With the failure of the bonus bill, the White House made plans to move the Bonus Army out of the city. President Hoover put up $100,000 of his own money to give marchers free transportation home. The problem was, most of the protesters didn't have homes. That's why they were in Washington. Only about 25% of the Bonus Army took up Hoover's offer, and the rest remained with Waters, who pledged to stay in D.C. until 1945, if needed. On July 28th, Chief Pelham Glassford received orders from the commissioners of Washington, D.C. to evict the bonus marchers living in condemned buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue. The block was slated for redevelopment and the buildings had to be emptied. Glassford and his officers reluctantly approached the buildings and told their inhabitants they had to leave. The marchers protested, shouting Pelham had betrayed them. A few picked up bricks and threw them at the officers, striking one in the head. Another marcher stepped up to Glassford and ripped the badge off of his uniform. As the melee swelled, some police officers opened fire, killing one veteran instantly and mortally wounding another. The bonus march was now officially a riot. And that's in quotes. The D.C. Board of Commissioners immediately contacted President Hoover and requested federal assistance in clearing Pennsylvania Avenue. Hoover passed the order along to MacArthur, requesting that he use the Army. Quote, "You will have United States troops proceed immediately to the scene of the disorder. Surround the affected area and clear it without delay. Any women and children should be accorded every consideration and kindness. Use all humanity consistent with the execution of this order." End quote. MacArthur called up 600 soldiers from Fort Myers, a full brigade, and trucked them to Pennsylvania Avenue. General MacArthur arrived on the scene at 4:30 p.m. to personally direct the operation. He didn't want to remain back at headquarters, as commanders usually do in situations like this. MacArthur's aide, Major Dwight D. Eisenhower, pleaded with his boss to remain behind. "Things could get ugly," he said. But MacArthur would have none of it. He wanted to see it all unfold as he wanted it to be there firsthand. A brigade of infantry men snapped on their bayonets and began marching in columns of four. In front was Major George S. Patton, Jr. on a horse. He kicked his heels and signaled the advance of a line of cavalry. Behind him were six Renault tanks from World War I. A machine gun crew prepared an emplacement on the avenue. Some naive bonus marchers thought it was a parade. People hung out of the windows and gathered on sidewalks to watch. As marchers became aware that this was Armageddon, they started throwing bottles and rocks. Some ran. Others held their ground and prepared for hand-to-hand combat. The infantry halted and donned gas masks. Tear gas canisters exploded, shrouding the whole scene in acrid smoke. Patton suddenly led a cavalry charge with sabers drawn and began beating bonus marchers with the flat of his sword. One vet, tears streaming down his face, yelled, "This flag means nothing to me after this." MacArthur ordered him to be arrested. Pennsylvania Avenue emptied as the men fled across the Anacostia River into the larger shantytown encampment. MacArthur ordered his soldiers to pursue the veterans across the Anacostia River and raise the main bonus army camp. President Hoover caught wind of MacArthur's plan and rushed an order for him to cease and desist. MacArthur's original orders had only extended to clearing Pennsylvania Avenue, not driving the whole bonus army out of town by force. And Major Eisenhower received the message from the White House and handed it to his four-star boss. MacArthur glanced down at the paper, still in Ike's hand, and said, "I can't be bothered to read a letter during a military operation." The troops crossed the 11th Street Bridge into Anacostia Flats. They shot tear gas into the unsuspecting encampment as they advanced, driving residents out of their tents and shacks. Then the soldiers systematically burned the shanties, destroying, in many cases, everything the marchers owned. MacArthur saw to it that Anacostia was completely leveled so that no marcher could ever return. The following morning, back in Albany, New York, Governor Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the midst of a campaign against President Herbert Hoover for the White House, received a stack of the day's newspapers. Headlines blared the news of the bonus army's rout. FDR sat in stunned silence. taking in the details. After a while, he looked up at an aide and said simply, "I think I've just won the election." Roosevelt would later remark that Hoover simply, quote, should have invited a delegation into the White House for coffee and sandwiches, end quote. 1 year later, now in the White House, President Roosevelt faced a smaller repeat of the bonus march. Having learned a lesson from Hoover, the president then offered the men comfortable quarters at Fort Hunt, sent his wife Eleanor as an unofficial emissary, and offered all the marchers jobs with the CCC and later the WPA. Meanwhile, the now Democratic Congress passed the bonus bill and sent it to Roosevelt to sign into law. But FDR, like his predecessor, disapproved of the deficit spending and vetoed the legislation. Congress would override FDR's veto in 1936. We're getting pretty close to that 1945 number, aren't we? Going back to the article. The surviving World War I veterans got their bonus checks later that year. Many would long remember the difference that money made in those hard times of the Great Depression. Perhaps the most important legacy of the bonus march was the lesson it taught the country about how to treat its veterans. While the fighting still raged in 1944 during World War II, Congress considered what to do when 12 million veterans returned home from the war. To its credit, Congress didn't just hand out a post-dated check and call it even. Rather, it passed the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill. The GI Bill had provisions for education, housing, and unemployment. Almost 8 million veterans took advantage of the GI Bill, one of the most important pieces of legislation in those past 100 years. The bill and the veterans it served remade America for the better. And that probably never would have happened if not for the challenge of the Bonus Army. There is so much I could say about this article, but I will leave it to you to think of. We need a break here, a little bit of lightheartedness. Oh, I wanted to read this. This is a quote from Will Rogers. "The money was all appropriated for the top in the hopes that it would trickle down to the needy. And Mr. Hoover didn't know that money trickled up. Give it to the people at the bottom, and the people at the top will have it before night, anyhow. But it will at least have passed through the poor fellow's hands." I thought that was quite appropriate. Okay. On a lighter note, the title of this is called "I Was a Vietnam War Helmet, and This Is My Story." And this was from the Breakfast Club, Veterans Breakfast Club group. At our last Veterans Breakfast Club event, we talked about the uses and abuses of the M1 steel pot helmet, which was standard issue from 1941 through 1985. After the event, Vietnam veteran Bill Moran, who served in the 199th Light Infantry Brigade, B Company, 5th Battalion, 12th Infantry, from October 1969 through October 1970, somehow communicated with his old Vietnam War helmet and ask that it send a letter to me explaining the war from its perspective. Below is the helmet's response. Dear Todd, first of all, I'm a helmet. My full name is Helmet, Steel, M1. Nowhere in that name do you see the word, quote, pot. I was never a pot and never intended to be used as one. I am 3 pounds of pure, non-magnetic Hadfield manganese steel. I can stop a .45 caliber bullet at near point-blank range. And with my front visor and slightly flanged sides and rear, I can keep rain from dripping down your collar and still look stylish. Topping it all off is a tastefully subdued olive drab paint job with a little silica sand mixed in for rich texture. If I weren't so darn useful, I might be considered a work of art. With all of this going for me, you'd think Bill would have worn me all the time, but he didn't. He typically wore me only at night, when few could behold my understated elegance. Why night? Because that's when Bill was in the prone position. It rained almost every night, sometimes all night, and I kept his head dry. The only other part of him that stayed dry was his M16 and my cousin Boonie, which he stashed away somewhere. More on cousin Boonie in a bit. Bill acted a little strange at night, I must say. He wrapped himself in his poncho liner and hugged his M16. Sometimes he'd dream. With the M16 held so close, I sometimes wondered who he was dreaming about. I'm probably better off not knowing. When dawn broke off Bill's head, I went. And then, and this is hard to talk about, he'd set me on the ground and sit on me, as if I were a random rock or cheap stool. He'd grab his pack, reach in, and pull out cousin Boonie. A couple dusting swipes of the hand, and Boonie was on Bill's head. I got stuffed back in the pack. Everyone loved cousin Boonie. I never understood it. Boonie's full name varied. At first he called himself Hat, Jungle, with insect net. Then he changed his name to Hat, Camouflage, Tropical Combat, Type 2. Finally, he became Hat, Sun, or Hat, Sun, Hot Weather. What a diva. Whatever name, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, all thought Boonie was the greatest and wanted to wear him all the time. I sometimes think the men loved cousin Boonie because Army brass didn't. They thought Boonie looked unprofessional and sloppy with his wide brim flapping and his top all wrinkled and crushed. Sure, he may have shielded faces against sun and rain, and he wasn't heavy like I was, and he did have a lightweight drawstring to secure him in the wind. Unlike me, he was easy to pack. But could he stop a bullet? Now, it's true, some have claimed that my elegant contours stood out in the rugged bush, making my wearer an easier target for the VC or NVA. Boonie allegedly had a more natural outline and blended in with the foliage better, but I've never read that in a textbook, and I've never seen that in a movie. It's all hearsay. While cousin Boonie was getting all the love and attention during the day, I got stashed in Bill's rucksack with the insect repellent, sea rations, ammo, C4, and water. It was humiliating. But every once in a while, I'd hear the call, "Contact! Contact!" Or sometimes, "Incoming!" Then all of a sudden, Bill would pull me out, stuff old Boonie away, and put me on his head. It was glorious. For a few minutes or hours, I was the hero, deflecting shrapnel, protecting Bill's head from dirt and exploding foliage. I like to think I might have saved Bill's life a few times, or at least kept him from getting hurt. Then the noise would stop and smoke clear, and back into the pack I went. There were other times he'd pull me out. These moments weren't as, how should I say it, elevating. We'd be tramping through dense jungle for a few days and then come upon a stream or large puddle. I'd hear Bill say, "Bath time." Out I'd come. The first few times I thought he might put me on his head, but no. He turned me upside down and filled me with water. Again, this is hard to talk about. It's very humiliating. Every once in a while, we'd have short stand-downs in the rear, and Bill would pull me out, flip me over, open side up, and set me down on the ground. Then he'd empty his pockets and pack and fill me up with odds and ends, cigarettes and lighter, a deck of cards, a couple crinkled letters, even dog tags and a rosary. He tossed those and other things into me like I was a change folder or a junk drawer. I'd get filled up to my elegantly flanged brim. What a life. I know some of my brothers had it worse. I've heard stories that would make your webbing quiver. Stories of M1 Vietnam War helmets being used as makeshift entrenching tools or, dare I say it, toilets. Finally, in September 1970, Bill became a short-timer. Isn't it funny how in those last few weeks and days, the short-timers get all cozy with their helmets? Bill started wearing me more often to protect his precious head. It's like he suddenly realized he might make it home in one piece. He did make it home, thanks in a small part to me. Bill boarded the Freedom Bird on October 1. But I didn't make it home with him. I got left behind like a jilted girlfriend. What happens in Nam stays in Nam. Isn't that the saying? Didn't even get a thank you or a parting conversation. And who boarded the plane with Bill? That's right, Cousin Booney. Booney even got a special inscription sewn into his brim before he left, bragging about all the great places he'd seen. He even got to wear Bill's sergeant stripes. Did Booney ever stop a bullet? No. All he ever did was protect Bill's neck from a little sunburn. But I'm not bitter. I genuinely wish the best for Booney and hope he's happy, sitting on a shelf somewhere in Pittsburgh, looking as dirty and wrinkled as the day he left. Tan Son Nut. As for me, I sometimes think I'd rather have ridden off into the sunset to D&D Auto Salvage and Metal Recycling. D&D began as a small hauling and used auto parts operations shortly after Bill came home. Today they're a full-service metal recycling company with a second location in Pittsburgh. That's a state-of-the-art scrap yard. They treat their metal, ferrous and non-ferrous, well. Do you think they could handle 3 pounds of pure non-magnetic Hadfield manganese steel? Sincerely, Bill's Helmet, a.k.a. Steel Pot. Oh, I hope you found that worth listening to. I learned when I was in the military, especially during the Vietnam War, it was often referred to as MASH humor. And that, believe me, is what got many through the day. We had to learn to laugh at ourselves and with each other, or the days just wouldn't have come out right. Maybe that's why some of us have a very wry humor. I don't know. I'm not sure. But when it's a tough day, sometimes that sense of humor does have a hard side to it. I thought I would read you, I selected a couple of general quotes. And, of course, a lot of these are very familiar to you, especially their authors. This one is by none other than Douglas MacArthur. And I have to say, this is one thing that just really bothers me. When we were listening to this article about how the military was crashing in on the veterans, those were military veterans. And maybe this author neglected to find any details of it, but why didn't the military just go out there and have a talk with these guys? That they were their own. Talk about being a little confused here as I was reading the story. I hope that caught your attention on it, too. This one, you really have to think of what he's saying. George Patton says, "No good decision was ever made in a swivel chair." Obvious thing is that somebody is sitting in an office, right? He said swivel chair. He meant somebody who can turn to the left or to the right or to the middle. That's what he was talking about. No good decision was ever made in a swivel chair. On the battlefield, this is a quote by Dan Lipinski. On the battlefield, the military pledges to leave no soldier behind. As a nation, let it be our pledge that when they return home, we leave no veteran behind. Elmer Davis says this, "This nation will remain the land of the free only so long as it is the home of the brave." Oh my gosh, it's the end of the show. Again, respect your military veterans. Have a good week. Stay calm. Stay cool. Bye for now.
At Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
My name is Mr. Rowe, I am the host of Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion.